Hello, and welcome to this download from Princeton University Press. My name is George Miller, and my guest today is David Runciman, whose new book, Political Hypocrisy, The Mask of Power from Hobbes to Orwell and Beyond, has recently been published. Writing in the Financial Times, Samuel Britton hailed the book for its readability and timeliness, and it's true that it's almost impossible to open a newspaper, switch on the TV, or read a political blog without being confronted with the issue of political hypocrisy. Finding and exposing hypocrites seems to lie at the very heart of our contemporary political culture. And one of the aims of David Runciman's book is to show that this is also an issue with an illuminating history. David calls democratic politics a great dance of hypocrisy and anti-hypocrisy in his introduction, and I began by asking him to explain how he conceptualized this dance.
Well, I think in politics there's a constant endeavor to expose hypocrisy because people don't like hypocrisy. It's a very useful weapon in order to attack an opponent. But the exposure of hypocrisy, the anti-hypocritical movement, doesn't drive hypocrisy out of politics. It doesn't even diminish the amount of hypocrisy there is. If anything, it just increases it. Because on the one hand, the more you try and find it, the more of it you find. And on the other hand, the person who's doing the accusing is always easily then finding the tables turned on themselves. There's nothing in politics like someone saying you're a hypocrite and then discovering something about themselves which they have to conceal. And so the dance is this endless round of masking and unmasking. And as I try and describe in the book, it's been going on and it's been described for at least 350 years and maybe 2,500 years, and it's showing no sign of stopping.
And in your view, if we concentrate, as the media so often does, on the dance, we're missing something about the bigger picture of how democratic politics functions.
Yeah, I think the focusing on the dance, there's a tendency to get caught up with the spectacle of it. It's exciting, it's dramatic, it's also often quite enjoyable, the exposure of hypocrites. I think it would be hypocritical of anyone to deny that there isn't pleasure to be had in seeing a politician hoist by their own petard. And that tends inevitably to be the focus, but it's very short-termist. It's the constant identifying of the new politician who claims to be virtuous or different or somehow to be above it, and then seeing them brought down to size. But there's something I try and argue in the book wider going on here. There's a way of thinking about hypocrisy that gets you away from this relentless focus on individuals, the charges they make, the charges that are made against them. What I try and do in the book is look at the dynamics of hypocrisy that get you just beyond this obsession with personality and personal hypocrisy.
I suppose the common sense reaction, the one that's promulgated by the media, would be that hypocrisy is a bad thing. It should be rooted out and exposed. Peter Oborne, and you quote him as a sort of leading proponent of that view. And I just wondered why you don't share that view, that it's something that can be extirpated.
The Peter Oborne example, I use it in the book for two reasons. One is simply to point out that in the history that I tell, you see this demand for a cleanup of politics, of driving out of the hypocrites, coming up over and over again. The parallel that I draw is between Oborne writing in 2004 about the Blair government and Anthony Trollope writing in right bang in the middle of the 19th century in 1855 about what he sees as the terrible hypocrisy that pervades Parliament. Now, if this argument has been going on in more or less the same form for at least 150 years, that suggests there's something futile about it. And the temptation is always to think, well, people haven't pushed hard enough, but these people are pushing as hard as they can. But the other reason I think Oborne's account is problematic is that it's simply incoherent. And he's a very good example, I think. He's the kind of journalist writing for the Daily Mail, previously for The Spectator, constantly hounding politicians for their hypocrisy. And yet the politicians loathe being called hypocrites by journalists whose own standards couldn't possibly match up to those that they're demanding of the politicians. And though it produces a kind of poisonous mistrust between politicians and journalists. The journalists never succeed in driving the hypocrites out. What the journalists succeed in doing is turning the politicians back on them. So if this has been going on for 150 years, and if the problem is still there, if anything, in an even more acute form, my feeling is you're not going to solve it by saying, we must do something about this once and for all.
And it's the contention of your book that we have things we can learn by looking at the liberal democratic philosophical tradition. So you don't principally look at the ancient Greeks or Roman politics or Machiavelli, you sort of home in and start your lineage with Hobbes. Can you say a bit about how and why you established that particular sequence of thinkers?
Yeah, it's partly because there usually seems in the history of ideas to be a kind of choice. On the one hand, you have the people, Trollope or Oborne or whoever, who are taking a real stand against hypocrisy. And then the alternative often seems to be presented as a kind of deep cynicism, a resignation, an acceptance that hypocrisy is just a part of politics. It's all a game. It's all an act. It's what you can get away with. And even though it's often unfair to the writers who are drawn into this, people like Machiavelli are often the names that are dropped in this context, the people who are thought to have this deep realism / cynicism about politics. And what I want to suggest is there is an alternative to these two lines of thought, the sanctimony of the anti-hypocrites and the cynicism of the realists. And it does come in the liberal democratic tradition. There are a series of liberal democratic writers, and I say this tradition runs from Hobbes through to Orwell, who are not sanctimonious, who aren't straightforward anti-hypocrites, but nor are they the kind of cynics who say, well, in politics, hypocrisy is a necessary feature of political life and it's what you can get away with. What they try and do is say some kinds of hypocrisy are not just acceptable, but inevitable and perhaps even desirable. But other kinds of hypocrisy aren't. And the key question is not, is this person a hypocrite? It's what kind of hypocrite they are. And I think you only get it in this tradition. I think the outside the tradition tends to paint it in all or nothing terms. And that's always the problem with hypocrisy. It seems to be you're either against it, and I think that's self-defeating, or you just acquiesce in it. And I think, and I share those people who think, that that's too cynical. I want something else, and I think there is a something else.
There's a sort of realistic or pragmatic approach to the reality of hypocrisy in politics.
Yeah, it's realistic and it's pragmatic, but it's not that anything goes cynicism. And what's striking about the people that I talk about is in their own terms, and indeed in their own reputations, they are anti-hypocrites. Hobbes and Orwell, both in their own writing, use the idea of hypocrisy as something they want to attack. But they also recognise that you can't be promiscuous in how you use that word. You have to be very careful not always to attack hypocrisy and sometimes not to use the word, but at other times to say this kind of hypocrisy is okay if you want to be able to isolate the forms of hypocrisy that you think are damaging. And the danger of the usual arguments about hypocrisy is they don't isolate different kinds. So you get these all or nothing arguments, and I think the all or nothing arguments just take you back in the endless dance. Hobbes, Orwell, and others I talk about, Bentham, John Adams, the American president. These are people who actually, I think, rare for political thinkers, give you a step outside of that dance and give you a take on it that allows you to make the relevant distinctions so that you're not always either attacking them or defending them.
In the book, you say that the American Revolution was an instance par excellence of hypocrisy being an issue in political life. Can you say a bit about the forces that were in play at that time?
Well, I try and identify two. The best known one, the one that tends to get written about, is the question of slavery. And some of that is in retrospect, but even at the time, both sides recognised that there was a problem with hypocrisy here, that the American champions of freedom looked like hypocrites because they were the slave owners. But the British, who were accusing them of that hypocrisy, also looked like hypocrites because they were the ones who had invented and were sanctioning the slave trade. And so both sides recognised that there was something that had to be stepped away from here if they weren't both going to get sucked into this endless escalation of charges of hypocrisy and anti-hypocrisy. But the other side of it, the bit that I'm more interested in, is that many of the leading figures on the American side drew on a European tradition that included people like Mandeville and Hobbes, but other people as well, to try and address this question of, is it possible to find a place for sincerity in politics without becoming sanctimonious, without actually just escalating the opportunities for people to accuse you of hypocrisy? And they had, the people I look at are Franklin, Jefferson and Adams, and they had some very interesting things to say about this, drawing on this European heritage. And of the three, it's the least well-known, John Adams, who I think in the end comes up with the most sophisticated answer to this, because he's in some ways closest to Mandeville and Hobbes. And it's Jefferson, the best known, but also in some ways the most hypocritical of them, who looks the weakest when you look at the ways in which they try to assimilate European thought and yet portray themselves as champions of a new kind of American sincerity. But it's a difficult argument for them to make, and they recognise that, and that's why I'm interested in them. They know that it's hard. They know the dangers of cynicism on one side and sanctimony on the other, and they try and draw a line somewhere between these two, and it's fascinating to watch it because they're also doing real politics at the same time.
You touched earlier on Orwell, and I think some readers might be surprised by the figure who comes out of your book, because we think of Orwell as a sort of unflinching scourge of hypocrisy and, you know, brooking no alternative to alternative to clear, transparent prose and political life. And yet the Orwell in your book is a much more nuanced, much more complex figure in his relations to hypocrisy.
Sure. Again, it's this question of different kinds of hypocrisy, because Orwell absolutely was, as you said, a great champion of clear, transparent prose. But it didn't follow from that that he believed that political life had to be clear and transparent. And indeed, at various points, he defends a certain kind of English hypocrisy or democratic hypocrisy against the more open or even transparent forms of politics that he saw bubbling up on the continent of Europe, and then he imagined in a hypothetical future in 1984 and satirized in Animal Farm, where you get a kind of sincerity about power, where people haven't got anything to hide. And he was very conscious, I think, of the dangers in politics of reaching a point where no one has anything to hide. And I actually read 1984 as an example of that kind of a nightmarish vision of that kind of world, a world without hypocrisy, because hypocrisy, precondition of hypocrisy, is a certain kind of privacy. And given the choices, as Orwell saw them, English democratic hypocrisy was obviously to be preferred to what he calls societies that have reached such a pitch of degradation where the need for humbug has disappeared. But though he defends English democratic hypocrisy, he still wants to distinguish that from English imperial hypocrisy. And he says, I think, quite clearly that in English public life, one form of hypocrisy might save it. The democratic pretense to be slightly better than we really are. Another form might destroy it. The imperial pretense that power politics is not actually power politics, but involves some kind of consent on the part of the ruled. And he thought that we had to separate these two things out. When we run hypocrisy together as a single concept, a pejorative term that whatever it's applied to just paints it as bad and to be rooted out, you lose all of these distinctions. And people increasingly use Orwell these days as a kind of stick that you beat the hypocrites with. If Orwell didn't like it, it means it's hypocrisy. And if it's hypocrisy, it means Orwell wouldn't have liked it. And what I try and show is actually it really does depend. And some kinds of hypocrisy Orwell wouldn't just have liked. He would have said they were the saving of politics. But other kinds, yes, he would have agreed were disastrous.
I've been wondering if there is a difficulty in the sense that hypocrisy, in order to function, depends on masks and concealment. And in sort of enunciating its meta-narrative, you quote Bentham talking about how the essential characteristic of democracy depends on fictions. And I wondered if you see difficulties, because I know that some politicians have sort of said, well, you know, of course we politicians aren't hypocrites in response to your book. Is there a difficulty in sort of enunciating this kind of meta-narrative about hypocrisy and bringing it into the open?
Yeah, there is. I think there's a very deep problem with all of this, which is the relationship between hypocrisy and self-knowledge and self-awareness. And these kinds of arguments obviously depend on people being very conscious of the kinds of masks that they're wearing. But as writers from Mandeville onwards certainly realise, there's a real problem here, because for these masks to be effective, you really have to invest in them. You have to believe in them. Someone has to believe in them, because if everyone just sees masks, then the whole performance falls apart. It's the problem of the theatrical conception of political life. And so I think it's no coincidence that most, by no means all, but most of the people that I write about are not practicing politicians. They are looking at it from the outside. And even of the practicing politicians, the story about Adams and Jefferson is a story about one who I think has a deeper understanding of this problem, Adams, but in the end was the political failure. And Jefferson, the person who allowed himself, in a sense, to believe his own publicity and to succumb to his own mask, is the political success. So there is a real problem here, absolutely, with seeing how this would work coming from the mouth of a politician. I don't think it can come from the mouth of a politician, so maybe no politician is going to say that we are hypocrites. But that doesn't mean that there isn't something to be said from the outside about politics. And frankly, if you look at the people that I talk about, Hobbes, the greatest English political philosopher, Bentham, the greatest of the utilitarians, Orwell, the greatest political journalist of the 20th century, what these people have to say about politics has a kind of enduring truth to it, which I think goes beyond the inability of individual politicians in a political circumstance to really enunciate what's going on. So partly, I guess, this book is a kind of defense of political theory too, because you only get, I think, the truth about this problem from that one step back that these writers take.
One of the lessons from your book is that in some ways political culture remains very constant and the same things keep coming up. But I wondered, with reference to hypocrisy, if a very significant difference is the intensity of scrutiny that politicians undergo nowadays, and the internet and the 24-hour news and blogs and everything, and if that is actually changing the nature of politicians' relationship with the public.
Yeah, I think it is. One has to avoid the temptation to think there's more hypocrisy than there's ever been, because we certainly encounter more of it. But the reason we encounter more of it is that people have become more hypocritical, is that it's much easier to find. And the internet certainly, I think, has changed it. You just have to look at the blogging culture around this 2008 American presidential election. It is just a relentless round of exposing the hypocrisy of candidates who are pretending, whether it's Obama or McCain or Clinton, pretending to have risen above it all. And the internet makes that easy. It makes it too easy, because you can just drag up everything they've ever said or done or thought they said when the cameras weren't rolling or the tape machine was off, and then juxtapose it against what they're saying now, the face they're trying to present. And it breeds cynicism. There's no question. This is an example, I think, of the ways in which the search for hypocrisy to root out the cynicism just breeds the thing that it's trying to confront. It makes the politicians much more suspicious, closed off, cautious in some ways. It makes them mistrustful of the media. It makes the media more competitive in the search to find more instances of this. It turns the public off, but then the public can get involved themselves, because the blogging culture means anyone can expose the hypocrisy of anyone they don't like. So I think the problem is more acute, but it's not more acute in the sense that somehow we're about to tip over a cliff of degradation in politics and we're on the brink of anything going. I don't think that's true at all. It's still part of the same circle, the same dance. But because it's so intense, so relentless, 24 hours, because the time horizons are so short, one hypocrisy crisis or scandal is followed by another and another and another. That's why I think the kind of argument I make in this book, which takes the long view, it's historical, and it tries to put it in perspective, and it does take that step back. All of these writers, I imagine even Bentham, who thought that scrutiny was the answer to politics, would be horrified by the thought that you could have 24-hour scrutiny. All of them, I think, would see that this is the point where you need to take a step back and not just think we must find the next instance of hypocrisy, but ask, is this the kind of hypocrisy that's worth worrying about? Because some kinds are and some kinds aren't. And if you don't make that discrimination, you just end up going round in circles. And my book is an attempt to just take one step out of that circle and look at the whole thing.
David Runciman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I was talking to David Runciman, whose book, Political Hypocrisy, The Mask of Power, From Hobbes to Orwell and Beyond, is published by Princeton University Press and is available now. Thank you for listening.